tune out of the anti-white system and tune in to the pro-white system.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Thursday, the 20th of August, 2026, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. It's Thursday, which means it is Geopolitical Analysis Day, and who better to get our geopolitical analysis from than Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson from RussJournal.org, and also from RadioAlbion.com. Matt, good day, sir. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. There's really no one better out there. And the proof of that is how often I'm plagiarized by people, both from our own side, as well as we were just talking before we came on about how we talk about an issue, and within a month or so, we're hearing it in the mainstream, in one way or another. And the fact that I know elites listen to us, at least the more serious, you know, scholarly people on our side. They read the Barnes Review. I know that. This can't be a coincidence. And I suppose I should be flattered by all of that. We should be.
Yeah, well, I can recall quite a few times we've talked about subjects here, and then in the following weeks, GB News has started talking about them, or BBC have started talking about them. I was watching some news program over the weekend, and they were talking about the amount of debt that America is in, and also this issue with Japan and Japan's problems. They didn't go into it as much as we did about these finances, but we certainly seem to be ahead of the curve on a lot of these issues, particularly the Ukraine issue, when we were talking about what was happening over there before Russia's special military operation. And we are going to be talking a little bit about Ukraine today, but more so about the Baltic states and how they fit into the scheme of things. The title that we have here is NATO Invents Stories to Widen the War Through the Baltics. And for our notes, we're going to be using globalresearch.ca. Historically, one of the greatest dangers to a major power in the international system is letting smaller allies and clients drag that power into an unwise war. Both the United States and leading European powers seem inclined to make that blunder with respect to the Baltic republics. Too many US policymakers have not only tolerated, but also facilitated the obsession these allies, i.e. protectorates, have exhibited with defeating Russia in Ukraine and weakening their arch adversary overall. The belligerent behaviour of some of NATO's smallest members creates the prospect of disastrous results in Europe and beyond. A crucial policymaker, Kaja Kallas, is a former Prime Minister of Estonia and now serves as the European Union's High Representative for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy and Vice President of the European Commission. That does not help matters. Kallas is not only one of Ukraine's most avid supporters, but is also an outspoken Russophobe on a wide range of issues. Kallas has received strong vocal support from Dutch-born Ursula von der Leyen, an influential German politician and currently president of the European Commission. Kallas has repeatedly pressed her EU colleagues, as well as NATO officials and policymakers in other European governments, to make no concessions to Russia with respect to territorial or other issues involving Ukraine. Any compromises, she contends, would reward Moscow's aggression and increase the risk of a much larger war. So she definitely doesn't want to see an end to the war then, does she? Because obviously there has to be compromises at some point in order to put a stop to the war. The former Estonian leader combines such policy rigidity with an alarming degree of arrogance and overconfidence about Europe's power. In one speech, Kallas asserted that if NATO simply stayed united on policy, Russia stood no chance of prevailing in Ukraine or of achieving any of its other objectives. Horrific wars have emerged throughout history from far less hubris than she routinely displays with respect to the democratic West's policy towards Russia. And we shouldn't forget that Estonia itself is actually a tiny little country. And for her to be making threats to Russia when she comes from such a tiny little country, really, I think it demonstrates really why women shouldn't really be put in that position. The centrepiece of the current effort by leaders of the Baltic states to exacerbate tensions with Moscow is a propaganda campaign asserting that the Kremlin is plotting to launch military attacks on vulnerable NATO members in the near future. In mid-July, the presidents of Lithuania and Latvia warned that Russia may be preparing limited kinetic operations against NATO's eastern flank infrastructure to test Article 5, the provision in the North Atlantic Treaty proclaiming that an attack on any alliance member will be considered an attack on all. Latvian President Edgars Rinkevics asserted that the next few months or even the next 12 months will be crucial for Baltic security. And for the Baltic states to be exacerbating these tensions, I mean, Britain is exacerbating these tensions as well. Recently it came out, and this again, this is something that we've been talking about for a while here at Radio Albion, is the fact that these drones that are being used for attacking Russia, they're actually being made in Britain. And Russia spoke out last week and said that this is making it clear that Britain wants to accelerate this war. He wants to exasperate it, wants to increase things rather than reduce things, rather than try and wind things down to a peaceful solution. Britain is seeking to accelerate things. And it does make you wonder whether Russian bombs might end up hitting somewhere in Britain, because they'd certainly be entitled to do that, since it's British hardware that's being used for attacking Russia. So, but what we have here is Lithuania, Latvia and Estonia. They are the Baltic countries, and they're the ones pushing this against Ukraine. I've been to both Latvia and Lithuania, very good nationalists there, but they were very anti-Russian because of being occupied during the Soviet times. And a lot of them were actually going over there to fight in Ukraine. And this is years before the special military operation. And they were going over, lots of the nationalists there wanted to go and fight on the side of Ukraine. And this was all to do with Ukraine's image of neo-Nazi groups being in power and all the rest of it. So, but what was at the root of this, I think, was these issues with the Soviet Union, more so than with Russia, and the fact that Lithuania, Latvia and Estonia, they were all occupied by Russia. So this is the reason why they have this this thing against Russia. I mean, it has been referred to before by some people as daddy issues. But I don't think we can underestimate, really, their dislike of Russia. And effectively, this is just being encouraged by America and Britain, because it serves our purposes, basically. It serves the West purposes to have these countries calling out Russia, trying to get war against them. But in actual fact, if they were on their own, you know, they wouldn't be able to do any of this, because they haven't got the strength to. They're some of the smallest countries in Europe. What do you make of this, Matt? I know you've got in-depth commentary to make.
Oh yeah, it takes a certain level of mental deficiency to not be able to tell the difference between Stalinism and today's Russia. But Kallas herself has said that there is no difference. I mean, you really have to be very fooled. And I don't know if that's truly her motivation, but she talks like that all the time. Kallas, you know, having long hit the wall, and I know you mentioned that about women. I agree with you. They talk about her all the time, but in 2019, her coalition got 29% of the vote. Now, this is what sort of person she is. I know I had to look into her to find out where this fanaticism is coming from, and I found it. Second half of 2021, and it's continued to now, the energy crisis and everything else really hurt the Estonian economy. You had businesses shutting down everywhere. And when they asked for government assistance to pay for now the very high electricity and heating prices, when Kallas was prime minister, she said, no, we're not going to give you anything. The government should search for long-term solutions, he said, rather than handing out benefits. The free market should rule. Truth of the matter is, all this money was being sent to Ukraine. On top of all that, she was pushing, you know, gay marriage. And as all this was going on, her husband was making a fortune trading with Russia. There's no way she didn't know about that. The woman has no principles whatsoever. And at the same time, in July of 2025, I think it was July 2025, Kallas and the foreign ministers of the EU decided to take no action against Israel over the war crimes in Gaza and settler violence. So she's where she is because she's, you know, she plays the game. And, you know, she's a part of the inner core of the regime. As their economies, you know, their economies are struggling, and this is really the thesis of all of this. As their economies are struggling, the creation of this enemy, and it is a creation, a construction rather than a reality, that's pretty much the one thing that's holding these societies together. Now, I agree with you. You know, nationalism anywhere is excellent, and they do have good nationalists there. Ukraine does too. But you've had for a very long time Russian minorities who are often some of the most economically productive in the country. Nationalism does not require any nation to, you know, treat them poorly. There's nothing like that. You know, that's what our enemies say, that nationalism means that we think that we're superior to others. And of course, that's not the case at all. And if Russians leave, and they have been kind of trickling out for quite a while, some of the economic situation is going to get far worse as time goes on. But the truth is, the only thing that, you know, she's a member of the regime, and she's being told that militarization, to keep this war going at all costs, is the number one priority. But this is putting the Baltic states on the brink of financial collapse. You're talking about 35 billion euros in the three Baltic states, which is huge, considering how tiny they are. Lithuania is going to double their defense sector to 10% of GDP. And then they're going to Brussels for assistance here. The current Latvian prime minister wants to seek funds from the European Union to cover rising defense costs, like it's a force of nature. Severing ties with Moscow has been utterly disastrous. I remember when they became independent in 91, all that really meant was that Germany and mostly Sweden came in and economically colonized them. Which is one thing, you know, it wasn't necessarily a terrible thing because they didn't go through the disastrous situation that Russia and Ukraine did for a while. So this is all of their own making. And this is why Kallas, they claim that she's so popular, but her coalition has never gotten more than very full. In 2019, it was 29% of the vote. And when she tells business that because of her own policies and that of the EU, that they're not getting any assistance. Really, ultimately, it's because all this money is going to Ukraine. There's no way she is popular. One of the reasons she left the country. And why in heaven's name she is part of the security apparatus of the EU. She has zero experience in that matter. She has zero knowledge in that area. The number of female defense ministers in Europe makes me smile, at least. Or guys, people who are just lawyers, have no connection with security whatsoever, means that military policy is going to be totally politicized. And so these countries are slowly disintegrating, and the one thing they need is this enemy. What in heaven's name is it? Does Russia care about invading the Baltics? What interest would that solve? What, Russia's not big enough? it's absolutely absurd that they would even dream about it. And but this has been the ridiculous narrative that not just the Baltics, but everyone else. And Poland's involved in this, too. And that gets me nervous. You know, we talked about this before. The regime, at least a faction of the regime, wants to see Poland as the next Ukraine, which is terrifying, especially if you're Polish. It's going to mean the depopulation of another Slavic country. Poland, you know, there's some of the high brass that say there's no way we couldn't fight Russia for 2 seconds. Others who were trained by NATO that say, you know, it's no problem. We should get ready for this. Russia has no interest in any expansion whatsoever. She invaded Donbas as a preemptive measure to keep Ukraine from invading it and completely destroying it. They were at war with the Novorossiya, Donetsk, and Luhansk. That was their aim, and now they're a part of Russia. That war is pretty much over, but the regime is just thrashing around trying to find any reason to keep it going. And one of the reasons seems to be the Baltics, whether Kallas is in charge or anyone else. But I knew that if I looked into Kallas to some extent, I'd find what kind of person she is, and I was exactly correct.
Well, you brought up the Russian minorities there, and there are sizable Russian minorities, especially in Estonia and Latvia. And that's because in the Soviet times, Stalin moved people around. Something that's always been done. It's something that happens today. This is why we have multiculturalism, because it divides the nation, makes it more difficult for a nation to organize a resistance. So the Russians were exported to Latvia and Estonia, and now there are quite sizable Russian minorities there. And because Putin has went into Ukraine effectively to protect the Russian minorities' rights, which were being abused by Kiev. And of course, that's then going to make people that live in Latvia and Lithuania say, well, what about if he does that to us? We have a sizable Russian minority. What if Putin comes in here to protect these guys? And of course, the answer to that would be, well, don't abuse their human rights then. Don't ban them from speaking Russia and all the other things. But I mean, the root of this problem, this distrust, even though they're all white people together, the distrust goes back decades, and it's because one ethnic group is different to the other ethnic group, and of course they do retain their separate ethnicity. They still speak Russian. But what I was unaware of, Matt, you were saying there that they're actually extremely productive. They're the most productive there. Is that correct? I mean, what are you basing that on to say that the Russian minority?
Yeah, that's the case everywhere. It's the case in Moldova. That's the case everywhere. There's been the strong Russian presence in these places, even in Tsarist times. There's a couple of options. The first is, you know, Russians don't, if they were just treated properly, there's no reason that Russians could not accept and respect the nationalism of their host countries, so long as where they're in the majority, that they get, you know, they're not forced to use, you know, those languages. The second option is that they go to Putin and figure out a humane way of transferring the population. These are not unemployable people, to say the very least. And I think, you know, that would, you know, there's been a drain on of them anyway. Their numbers have gone way down over the last 20 years, regardless. And I would have no problem with either one of those. You know, but the Russian presence in the Baltics goes way back. It goes back to Ivan the Terrible. You know, but you know, it's kind of like they're sort of like the Han Chinese in places like Tibet. You know, they're always, you know, a bit wealthier than everyone else, and more productive than everyone else. It's a case in Transnistria. It's a case in Ukraine. It's simply how it is. So there's another element of contempt that comes from that. I think the best bet, because again, there is nothing wrong with the nationalism of these countries, so long as it doesn't, and so long as they're not going to Brussels saying, I want to, you know, attack Russia, that they simply return to Russia. They are, you know, usually they're fairly highly skilled people. and Russia needs them. There is nothing wrong with that, and encouraging that, even paying them to do that. That would be a humane solution to the problem. So I don't think there's anything wrong with that whatsoever. But even though I'm obviously a Russophile, I never want to hold any nationalist movement in contempt. That they're correct. That doesn't automatically mean we despise Russians. They may say that about the Soviet Union, but certainly not Russia today. So maybe the solution is not tons of people. A humane, gradual population transfer, where they're paid, their expenses to leave, and so they could become monoethnic. I have no problem with that. And Russia could certainly use their skills. That's my opinion.
Well, there is this other perception that Russia is it funds the antifas in these groups as well. When I was there over in Lithuania, and it was their celebration of their Independence Day, and they were honouring the fallen that gave their lives fighting against the Soviets at the end of the Second World War, effectively. And Russia had sponsored Antifa. They'd hired out a hotel, and they had sponsored Antifa to go there and disrupt the proceedings. And all of these Antifa were actually turned away at the airport. But it was certainly Russia that was actually funding that. So this is the other accusation, is that Russia funds these subversive groups to go against their nationalism. So these arguments between the two countries, basically.
Yeah. As you well know, anyone who's listened to me for more than a few hours knows that one of my big criticisms of Vladimir Putin is his narrative about World War II, the great patriotic war, the creation of modern Russia. It makes sense given how he was raised, being in the KGB when he was. But at the same time, Putin has said very harsh things about Marxism and the Jewish creation of, especially in the early Soviet Union. He's not been shy about that in the past. But his glorification of Stalin's victory against Hitler is, to me, completely outrageous. And that's been a huge area of criticism for me. And there's a faction of so-called Russian nationalists who support that, and another faction of Russian nationalists who would be on the German side. And, I've talked about the various pro-German Russian groups, the Okhot experiment and stuff like that. And of course, Ukrainians as well. And it's just been, I don't like it. I don't like hearing it, but he's made it a almost a centerpiece, claiming that Ukraine is run by neo-Nazis. It's the most absurd. I can't listen to it anymore. This group of Jews, these internationalist Jews being called Nazis. The fact that they use some of these groups as cannon fodder in no way means that this is somehow a national socialist state. But that's what that faction of Russians is saying. I can't stand it. That has to go. And, that's been a big area of criticism for me on Putin and the Russian government.
Well, I guess it's framed like that because they look back at the Great Patriotic War. They won the war. It was their heroes that won this war. And the bad guys were the Nazis. Therefore, Ukraine is against them today. Therefore, Ukraine are the Nazis. I think that's why it's framed that way. And also, I can imagine that Putin looks over at us over here in the West, and we're just totally desecrating the memory of our ancestors with all the anti-white policies. And I guess he says, well, we're certainly not going to do that. We're going to say our ancestors were heroes, even if they weren't. So we're going to do the opposite of what the West is doing. So, that might count for it. And also, you're like, if you've got competitors and other countries around you, and you're seeing that they're going to be subverting you, which the West was doing, it was sponsoring Navalny. And then on Russia's side, he's going to sponsor the Antifa in the West in the same way that the West sponsors Navalny, and he does sponsor the Ukrainian neo-Nazis. And the subversives, those are the subversives in the East, and the subversives in the West are the Antifa. So if it was another group, perhaps he wouldn't be supporting Antifa. Perhaps he would be supporting right-wing groups. So perhaps he does in some places. I mean, the definition,
and Lavrov has used this before. I know the initial leadership of Donetsk used this. The definition of fascism has no relation to anything that Mussolini said or that how we would use it. The gay rights parade that they tried to force on certain cities, which they had to cancel because the church, you know, fought them. That was considered Western fascism. So they're using the term to refer to any attack on Russian tradition anywhere. You know, Lavrov has, as you've mentioned, and Putin come out vehemently against the anti-white policies in the U.S. Lavrov has been, you know, Lavrov tends to say the things that a diplomatic guy like Putin won't say. But, you know, he says it on his behalf. He's condemned the anti-white policies of this country and Britain as well. But in general, the word fascism over there doesn't have the same meaning as it does here. In fact, it's very hard for non-specialists. You know, I found that a long time ago that, you know, the capitalist infiltration, you know, the early 90s, that's fascism. And, you know, they're all Jews. You know, it just doesn't. But that's the definition of the term, and I suppose that may come from the so-called patriotic war. But I guess the only sympathy I could ever have with that is that, you know, millions of Russians were killed. Belarus lost half its population. You know, I could see someone who doesn't think too deeply about it to say, okay, that's the fault of the Germans and their allies, not realizing the truth of the matter. But that's simplistic thinking, and superficial thinking, that, you know, I might understand it to a minimal extent, but any in depth thinking was gonna eliminate that. Yeah, it's true, and it's hard to blame them on that in that regard. But the glorification, even if it's indirect, of Stalin, which comes from that, is outrageous.
Getting back to our notes here. Predictably, Russian officials dismissed the warnings as cynical cover for NATO's own military build-up in the Baltic region. There is no question that such a provocative campaign by the Western powers has taken place and continues to do so. Indeed, a sizable build-up of NATO air, naval and ground forces has been occurring for years. One important move was the redeployment of US F-22 fighter planes to Estonia from Poland in the spring of 2023. The most significant Russian provocations have been repeated spy plane incursions into the airspace of the Baltic republics and Russia's other neighbours. Similar maritime incidents have taken place involving Russian naval and civilian vessels. Although Moscow's moves are foolish and needlessly antagonistic, they are hardly in the same category as the major NATO build-ups of troops, warplanes, and naval vessels. And again, I'll just pause there. I mean, because we've just had this instance here of these drones bombing Moscow. And Russia said that, you know, they reserve the right to respond effectively. I mean, that could be their response, is that they could go into the airspace of these countries that are around them just to say, look, we can go into your airspace, you know. We could be dropping bombs if we wanted to, but we're not. So, I mean, as it points out here, these Russian provocations, they may well actually be Russian response to things like that going on. And I guess we might see some sort of response like that to Britain, some invasion of British airspace or something similar, just to say, look, you should not be giving these drones to Ukraine so that they can carry out terrorist actions in Russia with them. Alarmist warnings from the Baltic governments also are nothing new, so cynical American observers might be tempted to respond to the latest flurry with indifference. However, Poland, a much more significant political and military player than the tiny Baltic countries, has been outlining similar alarming scenarios. There have been numerous warnings in recent weeks by Polish politicians following multiple media reports that Russia could carry out a limited military or hybrid provocation against Poland in the near future. In late June 2026, a leading Polish outlet called www.onet.pl reported that US intelligence had alerted its Polish counterparts about the possibility of a Russian attack. Prime Minister Donald Tusk said on July 3rd that the warnings should be taken seriously and noted that he had been issuing similar alerts for weeks. Poland is preparing very intensively for various scenarios, Tusk said. The possibility that the chronically anti-Russian American intelligence agencies are helping to foment such paranoia should be a matter of profound concern to Americans who are opposed to having the Ukraine conflict spiral into a full-blown NATO-Russia war. An especially sad development is how Donald Trump, who once justifiably scorned Washington's entanglement in Ukraine as a folly, now seems firmly committed to perpetuating NATO's showdown with Moscow. Baltic hardliners undoubtedly take comfort in the Trump administration's new course. Now, I guess Donald Trump, most of his time, has been caught up with this ridiculous war in Iran, and I haven't really heard very much about America's relations to the Ukraine war. But we have to bear in mind that it was only recently that, I momentarily forget his name, that American politician died after visiting a drone factory in Ukraine, which shows you that it's still going on. It's just it's not mainstream, and they're talking more about Iran. But America's support for Ukraine and their attacks is still continuing. Do you know what is being referred to here, Matt? Has there been any other sort of increase in America's support for Ukraine? Do you know about? Oh, Lindsay, and it was Lindsay, and now I forget his second name again as well. That was the politician that recently died.
Yeah, Lindsey Graham.
That's it. That's
yeah, Lindsey Graham. I couldn't think of it either. Yeah. Yeah, his death was a boon to mankind. When I first read this, I was puzzled. I am not seeing anything like that. Mostly because of, you know, he's totally, you know, distracted. And mostly because, you know, the money simply isn't there. So, but taking American intelligence agencies seriously, I mean, we all know what they're capable of. These are the same people who created the Russiagate nonsense. You know, but it seems that places like, you know, Latvia, they're trying to blackmail Brussels. They're spending so much money on the military as their economy suffers from Russian sanctions and everything else. Its budget is in collapse. It's demanding European support. So they're demanding, I think, not that long ago, 7 billion euros from the EU on the ground that the country is suffering financial losses because of the anti-Russian sanctions that they helped put on. 15 billion euros for military needs over the next 7 years. That's far more than 5% of the GDP, and they can't afford this. The only way they could is shifting that to external support, and the fact is that the EU can't afford it. Brussels hasn't given in to this. Yeah, the EU, of course, is still continuing to support Ukraine, not like it used to be. But now, if in my book on the Ukraine war, you know, I've been talking about this for a long time. I spend quite a bit of time on the Polish issue, at least two or three chapters. The same military men there are simply saying that Poland is totally inexperienced militarily. They are not going to go up against a battle-hardened machine like Russia. That simply isn't going to happen. But you have politicians like Tusk, you know, who may override them, all based on fake intelligence from the U.S. And there's nothing solid. I've never seen any document. I've never seen anything. These are all vague, you know, anonymous sources said something, you know, things like that. These are almost neurotic. They have to justify the slaughter of 2 million Ukrainian military men. And so they have to come up with things like this. But there is simply, I can't think of any scenario where this would be in Russia's interest to do this. I think the only thing that he may be referring to is because Donald Trump is talking about nuclear weapons on Iran, he may be saying the same thing about Ukraine. And that's come up in the past. That's about the most, you know, but he's, you know, his relations with NATO are not, you know, NATO could, they could mobilize maybe 200,000 inexperienced men. They would be slaughtered before they even got to the border. There are no threat to Russia, all of NATO, yeah, including Iceland and Albania. You know, people don't realize Russia is the premier military force in the world today. Yeah, they had some hiccups in the beginning, but that was very brief, and they ironed all that out. Now that's all gone. They, you know, and their strategies and their methods now are tested on the battlefield. There is no way they would last a couple of hours with Russia today, certainly in the air, definitely on the ground, but certainly in the air. And, you know, Russia's anti-aircraft defense is some of the best, it is the best in the world. And all of the, not just experienced infantrymen, but experienced pilots, of which the EU has zero. Or has to say NATO has zero. So they can invent all the stories that they want. If they actually went through with this and tried to mobilize a force against Russia, you're talking about the slaughter of more European men and only men, and certainly the slaughter of Polish men and the best of Polish men, which is not, you know, this serves nobody. The regime may like it because it may take a little bit out of Russia's budget, but that's about it. It'll be like swatting a fly as far as Russia is concerned. So if they're going to keep talking like this, you know, I'm hoping that the faction in the Polish military that I talk about in my book, hopefully they prevail. Because any politician that oversees a slaughter is not going to be a politician for long. So hopefully they, but you know, I can't rely on people's rationality when it comes to Russia. And this has been what I underestimated in 2022, that the insanity, the obsession, and I'm using these words carefully. I'm not just throwing these out there as insults. I'm using them carefully. The neurotic aspect of this, the projection, the construction of this enemy rather than understanding them, they invent them, is, you know, so we can't rely on the rationality of European leaders.
Getting back to the notes here. The US military's already risky commitment to the Baltic countries is becoming more explicit and uncompromising. At a June 30th, 2016 ceremony in Valga, Estonia, the American commander of NATO's land forces in Europe made that intention quite clear, stating that you are, speaking to the alliance's Baltic members, ready to do more and following words with action, and the United States will be there alongside you. American General Chris Donahue asserted that is how deterrence is built, not with words from a podium, but with boots in the mud. Indeed, NATO is adding a new command headquarters to focus on developments in the Baltics. With President Trump having effectively capitulated to the NATO hawks, there is an alarming opportunity for anti-Russian zealots in the Baltic republics and elsewhere to push their pro-war agenda. Given Moscow's egregious behaviour towards its neighbours during both the communist era, one can readily understand the hatred that many people in those countries still harbour. But we must not let such poisonous historical memories drive current American policy. Too many officials in the Baltic states are courting a military conflagration that would consume not only their countries, but the United States as well. America does not have any security, economic, or moral interests at stake that even remotely justify incurring such a level of risk. Allowing NATO's mini-states to drag the United States into a major conflict with Russia, one with possible nuclear implications, would constitute the biggest folly of the post-World War II era. Now, we have another article from this year, but from a couple of months back in July, and it's again by globalresearch.ca. Along the borders with Russia, the Baltic countries, Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania are actively building physical defences, such as walls and bunkers, transforming the areas into heavily fortified zones with a high military presence. This reflects the Baltic countries' deep-rooted hostility towards Russia. Notably, these fortifications are widely supported by local communities, as ordinary citizens in these countries, fueled by Russophobic propaganda, are constructing personal bunkers, despite Moscow's assurances that it has no interest in war with NATO. But then again, Russia insisted that it had no interest in war with Ukraine, you see, and this is the argument that they will put. They will say, yes, but right up until the special military operation, Russia was saying, we're certainly not going to go to war in Ukraine, but of course they did. So you cannot really just go on what Moscow says, just the same as you can't go on what Britain says or America says, to be honest.
Well, let me throw this out there. Again, cite my book again. The Russian invasion was preemptive. They captured all the documents I've seen and read, the invasion documents from the Ukrainian High Command. There was a massive army on the border of Donbas region, and that's what led to the full-scale invasion. And it really makes sense. I mean, the Donbas had defeated Kiev many years ago, and getting it back, well, what would they do? They hate these people. That's why they're using terrorism against them today. It would be a slaughter again. It would be awful. Same thing goes for Crimea or anywhere else that now, of course, they're a part of Russia. So that's a very different situation here. But because the press is so tightly controlled in these areas, that argument isn't getting out. Just like in the rest of the EU, even RT and Sputnik, and I'm sure many others, are banned. And you simply don't have access to any other point of view. So in that sense, you may be absolutely correct that may be an issue. They simply don't know the facts of the case. But even if it were true, that would mean Russia now has a two-front war, and now would give NATO an actual legitimate reason to mobilize and fight, as disastrous it would be for them. You know, how is any of that in Russia's interest? Russia is large enough. So that's a huge difference between the Ukrainian case and this one. I just don't think the average person, and it's funny to just see people digging bunkers in their backyard. From the propaganda that they're getting, you know, it's almost funny. It's not funny, but it's almost funny. But that's what propaganda can do when you've banned everything else.
Well, the Russian viewpoint is completely banned from Europe. Russia Today, you can't get Russia Today here. That's banned Britain and Europe. And that was the first thing they did. The BBC is still over there in Russia reporting, but Russia's not allowed to report on what's going on to Europe. Russophobia serves as a central rhetorical tool employed by Europe to depict Moscow as the primary adversary. This narrative justifies various policies, such as significant military expenditures and shifts in civilian conduct and social attitudes. Europe has socially ingrained racist attitudes and aims to normalize actions such as the killing of Russians. Frequently, Russophobia is wrongly associated with patriotism, heightened geopolitical awareness, and legitimate international criticism, which obscures the distinction between rationality and racism. And of course, it's talking about racism against Russia, so it's really sort of talking about anti-nationalism more so than racism. I guess it goes back to this old term where race used to actually mean nation. So by saying they're against the Russians, that's saying that that's racist, right? Even though Russians are part of the same biological race as Americans and British and the rest. The impact on people is considerable, particularly for ethnic Russian minorities in the Baltic states. These communities are gradually losing the rights they once held. Initiatives to restrict the use of the Russian language in public spaces, education and media threaten their cultural identity. And of course, this is the reason why they're concerned that Russia's going to go in there to protect their minorities from this sort of thing happening, because this is what Ukraine was doing to the Russians in the Donbass. And that was the reason why Russia went in there. So this is why the Baltic states have this fear that Russia's going to go in there. It's because they're doing this. Wider efforts to diminish the influence of Russian culture, history and politics within these societies is creating an environment in which minority identities face increasing marginalization. And I guess they're putting that, they're using that sort of terminology to try and appeal to the West, which is constantly talking about minorities and racism and all the rest of it. Do you think, Matt?
Yeah, and that's very naive. It only matters when it refers to certain people. Russian, perfectly okay. Yeah, I wouldn't use the word racism at all. I don't particularly like Russophobia, but it's really the only word that's out there that everyone knows what you mean. You know, and as you're describing all of this, I think most of our listeners are saying, well, there's a really easy solution here. Just don't do those things. Trying to shut down, you know, Russian businesses and taking their capital, which would certainly serve their interests. You know, you don't do that, then you have no worry about a Russian invasion. It's almost a bizarre way of thinking. They create, and Russia would have a legitimate reason in that case if their minorities are being abused. They are leaving these countries in fairly large. It's been a trickle, but now it's a bit larger than that. Which is, that's not in the interest of the economy of the Baltics either. You know, it's to a great extent, there's this old mythology, especially developed during the Crimean War, and it continues to exist now, that Russians are Asians. The Mongols were not Asian, by the way. Wrong story, but Russians were not, and even if they were, they had no impact on you know, Russian genetics. Genetics studies have shown 100% that Russians are purely white European, etc., with an Aryan language, etc. You know, there's no doubt about that, but that propaganda is still very common there. So in that case, they may be talking about, yeah, they're a separate race altogether. And every once in a while, I come across someone who really believes that. Going to the West, and complaining about racism against Russia, it's a tremendous naivete, and I can't imagine that Lavrov, he's the opposite of naive. It's like, you know, Putin talking about the neo-Nazis who run Kiev. That obviously hasn't worked. It's not true. It's an absurdity. You know, and you trying to use that language is ridiculous. It is true, however, that in some cases, the propaganda that Russians aren't European, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and hence it is a racial battle, has come up. To what extent that's in the Baltic, in the various Baltic nationalist movements, I don't know. I tend to think that it's relatively common, despite the fact that there is no basis for it. Now, Latvia today, it's not even 2 million people. Russian culture has largely been banned. 36% of Latvia speak Russian as a first language. Segregation based on ethnicity is government policy. Now, even the UN has gotten involved here. Even the UN has condemned Latvia in this regard. So you get this, I don't know, cocktail of Russophobia, plus these so-called American intelligence reports that they're going to be invaded. So we got to go in our backyard and dig a bunker. Yeah, it is funny. Okay, I decided it's funny. That a war with Russia is going to be the solution to all of our problems. And as these economies, not just the Baltics, but elsewhere, Germany especially, as these economies dissolve, Russia as this imminent threat is very convenient for them. Now, again, I don't want to keep pushing my book here, but I go through the rearmament plan in Europe. The rearmament plan has been a disaster, since so many of the new tanks And it used to be, you know, artillery pieces don't work. I know we've talked about that on this show before. I talked about it on a solo show when you were away. The disarmament, rearmament, I'm sorry, has been an utter disaster. And like just like in the U.S., they may have, you know, F-16s, but whether they have enough pilots to fly them, and whether or not, you know, these guys are going up in the air in Ukraine and getting shot down. They're up 2 feet off the ground and they get shot down. That means they're lying to these guys, these boys, these officers. You know, it's awful. It's absolutely disgusting. They know that these are just shiny metal caskets for these guys. And I guess it's the panacea for this stagnant and declining capitalism there.
I think Russophobia is quite a good term. It's quite an accurate term, referring it to as racism. Yeah, I'm not too keen on that. NATO and EU member states support this state-sanctioned racism against Russians. Ironically, these discriminatory actions conflict with the EU's so-called core principles of protecting minorities, promoting cultural diversity, and defending human rights. Another demonstration of Western hypocrisy. Yes, but the EU would just say, yes, but they're white people. They're not a minority, they're white people. NATO and the EU have actively influenced the Baltic states by framing them as a defensive barrier against Russia and as key players in promoting a strongly Russophobic narrative that strengthens the region against Moscow. The main reason for this openly state-backed racism is that depicting Russia as an existential threat is strategically vital. This narrative enables the EU to justify and support policies crucial for the bloc's unity and progress amidst current geopolitical challenges. Without a clear external adversary, these policies would face increased criticism and resistance from within, especially as many Europeans struggle with a cost of living crisis exacerbated by the many sanctions imposed on Russia. Portraying Russia as the enemy not only justifies the continuation of self-harming sanctions, but also leads to discrimination and sporadic persecution of ethnic Russians in EU and NATO countries. And I say that's just the Baltic countries. I'm not sure you would get this discrimination or persecution of Russians in places like Britain, but you certainly would get that in the Baltic countries. And even in Spain, I've heard of white Russians that have been deported from Spain while Spain is legalizing Moroccan immigrants, illegal immigrants with criminal records. So, I mean, this is going on. There is little meaningful resistance to these issues within the bloc, allowing the EU to ignore violations of minority self-determination rights and revealing clear hypocrisy. Ethnic Russians suffer, facing reduced opportunities and cultural pressures. The heavy militarization in the Baltic also raises questions about who truly benefits. For local communities, these measures often provide a tangible sense of reassurance and increased safety. The widespread feeling of insecurity, driven by fears of Russian aggression, leads many residents to view fortifications and a stronger military presence as safeguards rather than as oppressive. US President Donald Trump has consistently urged NATO members to increase their defense spending. The standard goal is for each of NATO's 32 members to dedicate about 2% of their GDP to defense. Recent EU statistics show that the Baltic states have significantly exceeded this target. In 2025, Lithuania allocated 4% of its GDP to defence, Latvia 3.7%, and Estonia 3.4%, marking a notable increase from early levels. But all of them together probably only make up 0.0001% of what a country like England, or Britain rather, or Germany actually sends to NATO, just because the size of these countries is so small. The combination of Russophobia, militarization and strategic posturing in the Baltic region shows a deliberate strategy by NATO and its allies. Although it offers perceived security benefits and strengthens institutions, this approach will deepen divisions as minorities, particularly the Russian, will feel the sustained pressure to assimilate or leave for Russia. And to be honest, that in the long term, that would be the best thing if they did leave the Baltic countries and go back to Russia. And then you'd have, you wouldn't have these problems then. They all go back to the Soviet Union. imposing a forced diversity on these Baltic countries by importing large Russian populations and then putting the Russian populations, pitting them against the Baltic populations. That's the cause of all of this. So if, as you say, Matt, they're the most industrially productive ones, I mean, it might mean that those countries have less gross domestic product for a few years, but it will soon manage to right itself, and then they wouldn't have this problem with these minorities there. So I could see that the end result of that might actually be positive for these Baltic countries, although it might be some small amount of upset in the meantime. What are your final thoughts on all of this today anyway, Matt?
Well, I've mentioned that, as you remember, a few minutes ago, as a definite possibility. For example, it wasn't that long ago, from 2007 to 2010, unemployment went from, like, in Lithuania, from like 4% to 20%. There you had massive Russian out migration. So as the economy there gets worse and worse, that's where you're going to see this volume. They're not even going to have to forcibly do it. But they can, they need to go to Putin and make a humane way of doing this. These aren't unemployable people. 615. I think right now, the number, about 615,000 out of a population of 3 million in Lithuania, about 4 million in Lithuania, have left the country. Most young people, most educated and with very good jobs. And Lithuania. Remember, Lithuania doesn't even share a border with Russia. So now it's not as that hasn't continued. But immigration from Lithuania became the highest among the EU countries. And I agree with you. There is no reason why there can't be a intelligent and rational movement of this population out, so that they could maintain a complete, but that's not going to look very good as far as EU is concerned. We want a monoracial nation, but I suppose when it affects Russians, it's okay. So this has been going on for a long time. I think the elderly may be a problem. These are the grandkids and great grandkids of the original migrants. It's not their fault, but they can always say, this has been going on anyway. It can be a gradual movement, and certainly Russia, needs these people. These are highly qualified people, and they tend to be anyway. And there is absolutely nothing ethically wrong with that. It would assist Russia. It would assist these people. And it would assist the Baltics. So now that issue is gone. But it can be really dicey for the EU to support something like that. But maybe the EU doesn't even have to be involved. Who knows?
Well, they don't seem to be stepping in. And I can't see them stepping in anytime soon and highlighting the Russophobia. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Matt. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I'll be back tomorrow with Grandpa Dan. God bless and hail victory.